What's in store for development in downtown Jacksonville? Turns out a lot. We'll speak with the man at the center of all the big plans in just a moment. Good Monday morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a good weekend out there. Thanks for starting your work week off with us, always live at 9, and our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, an update about big redevelopment projects as Downtown Investment Authority CEO Andre Wallace joins the show, and he takes your calls. Already getting emails and tweets, you can call us too. Get on the line now, 549-2937 to join the show. Then later, this month's edition of First Coast Success as Karen Bruni Mathis speaks with local developer Ed Burr. That's ahead. And Cole Pepper on a big coaching change for the Gators after Florida-Georgia weekend. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, the Cowford Chop House opened last week in downtown Jacksonville to much fanfare. The hot new steakhouse at the corner of Bay and Main. Just one of several projects that is renovating old downtown buildings in the city and bringing them back to new life. Earlier this month, work finally also began to renovate the old Barnett Bank building as well. Much of these projects stem from the work of the Downtown Investment Authority, and many projects are moving forward or are in the pipeline. We're going to start the hour with an update on what is moving in Jacksonville's urban core. The Cowford Chop House, the Barnett Bank Building, what's going on with downtown plans and bringing more students to downtown on the FSCJ campus. Also, what's happening in the La Villa area. All of this and more as CEO Andre Wallace is on the line to talk about downtown development and take your calls. Andre, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Good, thanks. And I know you're a little under the weather, so we really appreciate you getting on the phone with us and toughing it out on this program on this Monday morning. What are your questions for Andre Wallace, CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority? What would you like to see happen downtown in the way of development and growth? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Already getting your comments on our Facebook page. And so, Andre, let's begin with the much-anticipated opening of the Cowford Chop House that opened last week. How are you feeling about that opening? Looked like a lot of excitement. All right, and it's a Monday, isn't it? It's been that kind of Monday all the way around. Oh, my goodness. As we lose Andre Wallace, we're going to try to call him back. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about downtown development here on the show. All kinds of projects happening, from the Cowford Chop House to redevelopment of the historic Barnett Bank building. That's by what they call the Laura Street Trio, this collection of historic buildings. That's finally moving forward. Now, you might have also heard that FSCJ is going to be beefing up its presence downtown and bringing a student population downtown. And we're also hearing that the La Villa area is getting a new development. Okay. Do we have Andre Wallace back on the line? Andre, are you there?
Yes, Melissa, I'm here.
Okay. I was just asking you about the Cowford Chop House. How are you feeling about that opening? Lots of anticipation about that historic old brick building finally open to customers and diners. Your thoughts as that is sort of the centerpiece. As people come across the Main Street Bridge now, that's what they're going to see when they come into downtown Jacksonville. What are your thoughts about the opening of that new facility?
The facility is nicely done. I have to give Jacques and his daughter complete round of applause for everything they've done for that particular building itself. It has been long awaited. It is held that keeps RF in the region, gives it a chance. And great potential opportunity for other things as we like to get done along Bay Street and in the Elbow District itself. So the Downtown Investment Authority in the city, we're very excited about the project.
Sure, and it is part of the Elbow District, as you said, a small collection of bars and restaurants. And as CEO of the DIA, it seems as though you've been focused on developing downtown in nodes and in stages. So that area is a big area that you're focused on. Also, the Laura Street Trio, that collection of historic buildings on Laura Street. We're hearing now about work moving forward to renovate the old Barnett Bank building. How important is that project? And can you tell us where that stands? Give us the status on that project.
Yes, on the Barnett Bank building on Laura Street Trio, earlier this year, February, we moved forward with approving a financial incentive package for that project, for which we took from February all the way to spring to get the complete legal documents in place, get them approved by City Council. The developers moving forward now after having gotten their closed. The interior restoration of the Barnett Bank building now. So to the individual walking on the street, he may not see certain things going on, but inside they're doing, they're definitely ramping up the work itself. They've got some tenants that really want to have given them some timelines and they really need to get going. And so they can meet some of those time frames for those respective tenants for fall of 2018. So you're going to see a lot of activity in that Laura Street from Adams to Forsyth location, where you're going to see a lot of renovation work continuing from now all the way through, I would basically say, 2019.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Andre Wallace, CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority. What are your questions about movement on a number of downtown projects going forward? There's some excitement about this, and the number to join us is 549-2937. And it's been stop and go for so long with so many of these projects, Andre, but we do finally now seem to be seeing some stuff moving ahead. Let's also talk about what FSCJ is up to in terms of its downtown campus and how you see that fitting into the overall picture.
The FSCJ project is in full swing. They are renovating the bottom floor, which is the ground floor retail that will be their actual restaurant itself. Hopefully, they will have that delivered sometime between early spring and have that space ready. They will then continue to move up to the second, third, fourth, and fifth floors of the building, where they will be renovating those particular floors for student housing. And hopefully, they can bring that project to a conclusion. Certainly by the end of 2018 itself. So that is, again, a very important project. I understand that the concept of stop and go. Again, projects take time from a financial standpoint and align every revenue source up. Particularly, let me just give you an idea of just sitting on phone calls on just the Barnett Bank building. You got at least 5 to 8 different revenue sources that you're trying to get a project financed, and every revenue source or every financial institution has its own lawyers. So as you're sitting there trying to close a financing, the questions, the complexity, and everything takes time to get it done. So some of the projects, as aggressive we want to see them move, they're going to move in the time frame of when the financing closes. But the most important piece, Melissa, is that the financing is in place for those projects, and they are moving forward and will come to fruition.
And that's always the key. And then before we go to calls for you, and the number to join us, 549-2937. There's also a project in the works in the La Villa District on the western edge of the urban core. What's happening there, Andre?
In La Villa, there's two projects that are underway. One is nearing completion in December, and projects directed on Water Street, in front of the Federal Reserve, as well as in front of the Crown Osborne. That's La Villa Lofts. That is 130-unit residential development that is already 100% leased up, has a waiting list of at least 25 people. The developer, Rescore, they also broke ground on a second project in the La Villa area at Monroe Street, just north of Salvation Army property in the La Villa area, for roughly about another 110 units of multifamily apartments. And tomorrow morning at the Board of Directors, we're going to be talking about an actual third project in the La Villa area that is going to be a combination of, again, workforce housing, of about another 130 units. So we're beginning to bring more housing into the area. Melissa, we're looking to make sure that we're able to accommodate people, particularly in the service industry, and wherever those wages are, and all the way up to at least $75,000 annually from a salary standpoint. We feel like those are the sweet spots in terms of from a workforce standpoint, that we know that we need to be able to try to provide housing and make it palatable for people to live in downtown.
Yeah, and when you say, let me just jump in, when you say affordable housing, what define affordable? What will these units cost? How much will people be paying?
Some of the projects where we're looking at people that make at a minimum wage all the way up to $39,000. So we're trying to make sure that they don't pay much more than 30% to 35% of their salaries in terms of from a housing standpoint. And that's pretty much the affordable housing prototype. Then $40,000 to $75,000 annual salary is what we kind of call workforce housing. We're looking to make sure we produce that type of housing in the marketplace equally as well. So one of the things is we want to make sure that we have enough housing types for everyone that want to partake and live within downtown to be able to find attainable housing that fits their socioeconomic status.
All right, let's go to your calls now for Andre Wallace, CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority from the Calford Chop House, the Laura Street Trio, La Villa. What are your questions about the urban core projects? Quite a few of them. And we haven't even gotten into Shad Khan's plans for the shipyards yet, Andre. I want to talk to you about that, too. 549-2937, Rolando in St. John's. Rolando, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
All right, thanks. Go ahead.
So I moved down here from New York about a year and a half ago with my family. We invested in a restaurant in Orange Park. So my question is, when I go downtown, the biggest thing that I see is you can make it look nice, you can make it hospitable, but to me the biggest problem is security. What are they doing to address with all the rehabilitation, the security of downtown? If I want to invest in another restaurant, what are they going to do to make my customers feel safe to come down into the downtown area?
All right. Thanks for the question, Andre Wallace.
Yes. Rolando's not going to like this particular answer, but it's factual. Downtown has the best statistics with regards to crime within Jacksonville. In terms of, we have a bad perception with regards to it's unsafe. However, the perception tends to be people's reality. So therefore, we have to work on that. They're making sure they have more ambassadors in and around downtown to have presence downtown. And if people need an escort to a car, we can certainly make that available. In terms of example, from a policing standpoint, you're going to see it lose patrols and so within downtown itself. So I think much more that we have to do, Melissa, is to continue to combat the perception issue that it is unsafe within downtown. And that is just not the case. It is one of the safest.
Right.
You've
pointed that out many times, that statistically it's just as safe as anywhere else. How do we combat the perception? What are some efforts you're doing to combat that?
I mean, from my standpoint, Melissa, the best that we can do, since we do not, we don't manage it, so. One of the things is continued dialogue with JSO, continued dialogue with DDI, for which I am a board member of Downtown Vision. Again, making sure that our ambassadors are there on the street, that if people are walking and they need directions or they need an escort, that they're able to get just that. So we're involved in that.
Okay, I think we might have lost you there, Andre. Are you there, Andre?
Yes, I am.
Okay, this is not the best connection, but we're going to keep going. Let's go to Tom in NAS Jax. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I've got a concern for the gentleman on the line. Now, I know I'm a newcomer here in Jacksonville. I've only been here since 1994. Quite frankly, every year, probably twice a year at least, I hear in the news all these grandiose plans about what is going to happen in downtown Jacksonville. So many redevelopment plans. All this money that's being spent on committees, and apparently lawyers, I just learned, to work out the all the little machinations of what has to be done to improve downtown Jacksonville. So all this money has been spent since 1994. The only thing I've seen change downtown is the Landing has gone from a relatively busy retail space and restaurant space to a ghost town where half the building, half the retail space is empty. The restaurateurs come and go like you change your socks. And nothing has changed in downtown Jacksonville, but we spent a lot of money. Who's getting that money? What are they doing with it? Where is my tax money going? I don't have it. Downtown Jacksonville certainly doesn't have it.
Okay. Thanks for that, Tom. Andre Wallace, you're relatively new to... oh, boy. It has just been that kind of day. My gosh. Okay, let's go to Paul, who's downtown, while we try to get Andre Wallace back on the phone. Hi, Paul. Good morning. And Tom, I'll try to get your question answered in a minute. Hey, Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you today?
Okay, thanks. Go ahead, Paul.
Good. I've been in business downtown since 1987 and had several businesses. I've lived downtown for over 12 years. And it's a bad misconception that the downtown area does have the crime and the unsafeness. I've never felt unsafe down here. My businesses have never felt threatened in any way. And it's just sad that downtown hasn't taken off the way it should have.
Yeah, and Andre Wallace, I hope you heard at least part of that.
I heard Tom from NASX comment.
Okay.
And I did not hear the last caller's comment.
Yeah, and he just said that he feels badly that downtown has not realized its potential. Of course, you were hired to make that happen, to help downtown Jacksonville finally realize its potential. The Downtown Investment Authority was created as an independent agency to do just that. So why don't we go back to what Tom asked you a minute ago from down at NAS Jax. He feels that his tax dollars have gone to waste when it comes to these efforts. What about that?
I know Tom said he got to Jacksonville in 1994, so he was here probably almost some 20 years before I arrived. So I can't undo the past no whatsoever because I've been around for 2013. And nor am I going to be critical of any particular decision that took place prior to my arrival, because one of the things that you have to recognize is real estate goes in various different cycles, and you make the best educated investment that you possibly can during that real estate cycle. So in terms of where we're going now, there's a complete focus based upon the business investment strategy. And within that business investment strategy, the projects that you see moving forward are a direct correlation from that particular investment strategy. So we're meticulously checking off those particular projects that we know have the greatest opportunity to spur other real estate development within downtown. So we're sticking to that particular strategy. And certainly hope that we're going to be able to make sure that we make very strategic investments that spur other investment within downtown. Now, the last caller, Melissa, he said he felt bad because downtown hasn't reached its full potential. We know it hasn't reached its full potential. But we recognize that we have an opportunity to do just so, because between the Downtown Investment Authority and the administration, we're certainly focused on making sure that we transform and change our image. So,
okay, we're losing the connection again. And unfortunately, Andre, we're just going to have to wrap this up. This has just been too difficult. But he is Andre Wallace, CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority, as we continue to follow all of the moving parts on these projects. Andre, thanks so much for being with us. Much more still ahead on the program later. Cole Pepper with Sports News and Notes. He joins us every Monday as Florida sacks its coach. But up next, First Coast Success Profiles Greenpoint CEO Ed Burr. We'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Hey, Car Talk fans. If you're wondering why Click and Clack aren't here, NPR is no longer distributing the best of Car Talk. The good news is you can continue to listen to the podcasts of the program at cartalk.com. We hope you enjoy WJCT's new weekend schedule. For more information about the new programs, visit wjct.org/weekends.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name that we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues is now on twice a week. Blues Horizon, Monday and Wednesday nights at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
The sky's crying. Look at the tears roll down the street.
Welcome back. Well, he is the president and CEO of Greenpoint Holdings, a real estate company focused on sustainability. In today's edition of First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Financial News and Daily Record speaks with local developer Ed Burr.
Whether it's downtown, transportation, the city's utility, higher education, business recruitment, housing development, or politics in general, one influential name in Jacksonville rises to the top, and that's Ed Burr. Burr chairs the Florida State University Board of Trustees. He chaired the Jacks Chamber and the Jacksonville Transportation Authority. He currently chairs the Jacksonville Civic Council, and he also has served on the board of JEA, the city's utility, and he created the Monique Burr Foundation to honor his late wife. He also has a job, and that is as president and CEO of Greenpoint Holdings, a development company. Ed Burr, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you, Karen. It's an honor to be here.
Well, in Jacksonville and in Northeast Florida, when discussion turns to power players in Jacksonville, your name comes up. What is your role in the city's decision-making?
Oh, I obviously have no direct role in the city decision-making. I guess I have been involved in various aspects of our city, really in a hope to make our city a better place and to make a difference. I think when you look around the city of Jacksonville, there's a lot of folks that are called leaders who really dedicate time, energy, and sometimes treasure because they want to make Jacksonville and Northeast Florida a better place and make a difference. And if that is what I'm being called in that process, I'm honored to serve in that role.
Well, in your position, what do you see now as the city's biggest issues?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of issues confronting our city. Certainly crime is at the top of it, and I think we're making strides there to help address our crime rate. And certainly downtown, I think that's one of the lost opportunities that I'm more optimistic about today than I have been in a long time.
What makes you more optimistic today about downtown?
You know, Karen, I think it's leadership. You know, there's always been an energy to want to help downtown. But it seems like we have the right political and civic leaders who have focused on the future of downtown and making a different place. I think our mayor is focused on it, and I think his leadership will be very influential in that area.
Why did you create Greenpoint Holdings? What does Greenpoint do?
Well, Greenpoint was a company I formed after selling Landmark and to really take advantage of what was the disconnection in the real estate market and distressed asset buyings. And we started buying assets in 2010 and really now have 15 communities throughout the state of Florida and over 16,000 home sites that we control or residences that we have that we own and are slowly bringing those into the marketplace and helping people enjoy the American dream.
Now, those times in the late 2000s, that's when the recession set in. It wasn't a pretty picture in real estate at the time. How did you get through that?
Well, we were just starting, and frankly, if I would have had a great foresight, I would probably have waited a few years to start, because we spent about 2 years just trying to, find, because the markets froze, you couldn't buy anything. And we were fortunate. We had a clean balance sheet. We had capital. So we didn't really, from the time I started in 08 to 2010, we really didn't do a lot of business acquisitions in that time.
Talk about the foundation, the Monique Burr Foundation.
I lost Monique in a car wreck on October 22nd, 1996. We were in Napa Valley on a Tuesday afternoon, and a well-drilling truck blew out its left front tire and hit his head on, and she was killed instantly. And, she was a passionate child advocate, and she had worked a lot. She was on the original Mayor's Commission for Children, which it's ultimately was Children's Commission, now the Children's Alliance, I think, will be. But she worked on the board of the Children's Crisis Center, which was the Trauma Abuse Treatment Center. And she had a passion for children, especially in the area of child abuse prevention and intervention, with a focus on sexual abuse prevention intervention. So we carried that spirit on. And today, 20 years later, we have reached over 2 million children with our education prevention programs, bullying. We have a program called Child Safety Matters and Teen Safety Matters, which we teach free to the Florida public school students. And it's a bullying, cyberbullying, digital safety, abuse prevention, sexual abuse prevention program that truly is the best in the country. And I can say, I say that I want with as much modesty as possible, but I'm very proud of what our team has developed. Our national consultants have reviewed it and helped us with it. And we're going through the evidence-based testing today. We've already been through research-based testing to show that it's effective. And it truly can make a difference in a child's life. And we think can prevent tragedy from happening to children, and certainly intervenes in it. We never go into a school that there isn't someone, a child, that is currently being a victim that doesn't disclose it, and that child's now getting the help they need, and maybe the perpetrators or others are getting treated the way they need to be treated.
Well, Ed Burr, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And you can read a transcript of Karen's talk with Ed Burr in this week's Daily Record. Well, it's called Real Men Wear Pink, prominent local men working to raise money for the American Cancer Society this month by, you guessed it, wearing pink. And that's not all. One of these real men is Chef Tom Gray, owner and executive chef of Moxie Kitchen and Cocktails. And he is going to sweeten the deal if you donate to him on his mission to raise funds for the American Cancer Society. Hey, Chef Tom, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So tell me, what exactly is this Real Men Wear Pink thing all about?
So we've been raising money all month for breast cancer awareness. We had the breast cancer awareness walk last weekend. Mm-hmm. And everyone's having to get really creative and figure out ways to raise money. And John Phillips has been leading the charge.
Local attorney John Phillips.
Yes.
Beating everybody
yes.
on this thing. Okay.
So I told him my goal was to try to even just catch up with him.
Uh-huh.
So one of the things I came up with was an idea to actually cook dinner in somebody's home.
Really?
Yes. I also, in addition to that, to sweeten.
I'd pay for that.
So it's an opportunity. It's a $500 donation gets you a raffle ticket to win the dinner. We need to sell 12 tickets in order to do the dinner. We are right at the halfway mark. And to sweeten the deal, I went ahead and added in a little over $2,000 worth of wine from my private collection.
Get out of here.
Yes, to go with the dinner.
So you and several dozen other men all over town, you're running around town wearing pink, first of all, because you're wearing a pink and white check shirt today.
Yes.
And you're finding creative ways to raise money for the American Cancer Society. It is Breast Cancer Month. So let me just make sure I'm clear here. If people donate $500 right now to Chef Tom as part of his Real Men Wear Pink campaign, they could win the drawing to be selected at random for you, Chef Tom,
yes.
of Moxie Kitchen, to come to their house
yep.
with $2,000 worth of your fine wines,
yes,
personally curated by you, Chef Tom,
yep.
and you're going to cook them
and I'll cook
a gourmet meal
for six people.
That's amazing.
Thank you. Yes.
That's worth $500, I would think.
Easily.
Yeah.
It's priceless.
Yes. So, okay. So how can people enter to win?
So you can go to the American Cancer Society. It's acsevents.org site. And that's where we can donate. It's on my Instagram. It's in my bio, and my Instagram is Chef Tom Gray. Mm-hmm. And it's also on my Facebook, which is just Tom Gray. Mm-hmm. And there's a link there to donate.
Very exciting. Of course, you're well known for your success with Moxie Kitchen mm-hmm. at the St. John's Town Center, you and
yes.
your wife. But you also recently have opened a new place as well.
We did.
In the San Marcos Square called Town Hall.
Yes. So we have Moxie Kitchen and Cocktails in the town center, and then we have Town Hall right here in the center of town. So
whoever wins this dinner with you, will they get a menu that's kind of like a mix of both places?
I think it'll be a little bit of both. I'll customize it based on their preferences, and I think it'll be a little bit of each. Both businesses have been participating all month. Moxie has been doing a drink called The Sure Thing, and Tito's Vodka has been working with us for that. And then Town Hall has done a pink punch. So we have 2 days left. We have today and tomorrow. If you see the flyer online, it says the donation's in today, but we're letting it go through tomorrow. That's when the fundraising ends for Real Men Wear Pink.
So you just have 48 hours to donate to this and
but it
enter
literally
to,
takes seconds.
It literally takes only a moment. Enter to win a chance for Chef Tom to come to your house and create and cook a custom dinner for you and your family or your five best friends, served along with wine selections from his personal wine collection. His wife, Sarah Marie, will also join in. You won't have to lift a finger. This is like going out to dinner at one of their great restaurants, but they're going to come to you.
Bring it to you.
Pretty amazing. It's a $500 donation to Chef Tom's Real Men Wear Pink campaign. And as Tom said, go online or go to his Instagram page and make the donation either today or tomorrow. And it looks like you're giving John Phillips a run for his money.
I'm trying.
Just a little bit. All right. Well, good luck.
And thank
you. Yeah, this is an exciting effort. And I've run into several of the guys around town wearing their pink. So it's cool to see that. Yeah. And good luck to all of you.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back.
WJCT's Jaguar Season Parking is still available. Be part of the coolest tailgating downtown. Includes paved space, indoor bathroom access. Contact Holly Manuel at 358-6311 or log on to wjct.org/parking. Reserve your space today.
Listen to WJCT anytime, anywhere, even when you're away from your radio at wjct.org/listen and on iTunes Radio and the TuneIn Radio app. You can hear all of your favorite WJCT shows on demand anytime on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
WJCT offers a 24-hour classical music service dedicated to live classical music programming 24 hours a day. To find out more, visit us at wjct.org/HD.
Welcome back. The National Park Service has announced a proposal to more than double the peak season entrance fees at the country's busiest national parks, Shenandoah, Yosemite, Yellowstone, Grand Canyon, those parks. The Park Service said Tuesday it needs the revenue from the fees to address a nearly $12 billion backlog on deferred maintenance. But the announcement has been met with worries that the higher fees might push the parks out of reach for many Americans. Now, this news got us thinking about the national park right here in our own backyard, an incredible resource, a treasure. the Timaquan Ecological and Historic Preserve right here in Jacksonville. We're going to talk a little bit about the national parks right now as we welcome the Timaquan Park Superintendent, Chris Hughes, to Studio 5. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Melissa. How are you?
Good to see you. Also with us, Times Union columnist Mark Woods, author of Lassoing the Sun, A Year in America's National Parks.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you, Mark. So, Chris, you've taken over the role of superintendent of the Timaquan Park when the person who had that job for many years, Barbara Goodman, retired. And what a resource Timaquan is here in Jacksonville. We have a beautiful national park. With the news that these fees are going to be increased at the really big, busy national parks, is that going to happen here in Jacksonville too, or are fees going to stay the same?
One of the great things about the national parks here in Jacksonville is we actually don't charge fees. And so what I'd like to remind people is that only 118 out of 417 parks actually charge fees. So that still leaves us 299 parks to go to and not have to pay a fee. And here in Jacksonville, we have Fort Caroline National Memorial and Kingsley Plantation that you can go to at absolutely no cost.
And you oversee all of that. What are some news and notes you want to get the word out to the public about these amazing cultural resources that we have right here in our backyard?
Yeah, that's a good point, Melissa. The cultural resources, I think, are really important here because we span such a long period of history with the French, the Huguenots establishing at Fort Caroline, and then even some of the slave history out at Kingsley Plantation. So there's a constant reminder of where we come from, both as a culture, but then we also have 47,000 acres of natural area for people to explore.
That's right. Now, Mark Woods, of course, you spent a year traveling the nation and visiting national parks, and the result was your book, Lassoing the Sun, A Year in America's National Parks. Of course, our PBS filmmaker Ken Burns called them America's best idea. What do you think about this news that they might double the fees on some of those parks that you visited and wrote about?
Right. It's kind of mostly the big iconic ones like the Yosemites and Yellowstones and Grand Canyon. And my first reaction was kind of that there's still, it's going to jump from $25 or $30 to $70. My first reaction was that's still a bargain that, if you go to Disney, I think it's $122 or something like that for an adult and the parking, by the time you have a car full of a family going in, that's a mortgage.
yes.
But I think the more I thought about it, I don't like the idea because I don't want anybody to, the national park should be for everyone. And I'm afraid there will be, if you price out anyone, I just think it's wrong. So to compare Disney and it is apples and oranges. I'm a little troubled that it might scare away some folks that might say, well, $70 is too much for me, for my family to go there.
Right. They were initially intended to be free or nearly free as a way for Americans to enjoy beautiful natural lands. That was the intention.
Right, right.
That's why you wrote the book. You wanted to celebrate that.
Yeah, they're one of our most democratic things that, in other countries, that we say that only the wealthy can go to these spots. We've managed to preserve some of our most amazing, beautiful, historic spots, and they're supposed to be for everyone. So I would hate to have it that we price some Americans out of those places.
Now, Chris Hughes, here in our area in the Timaquan Preserve, as you mentioned, there are thousands of acres of really beautiful land and forest. Many people listening right now may not even realize what they can go and experience, what's available. What are some of your favorite spots?
Right off the bat, Cedar Point, I think, is just absolutely phenomenal. I mean, you can go out there. We have a great partnership with the city parks out there. You can go to Tiger Betts Point, and it's one of the last remaining pristine view sheds. You can't even see a cell tower. I mean, these are just great places where people can go and reset. These are very stressful lives we live here in the city, and so it's just nice to have these spots to be able to go to.
That's what I love about the Timaquan Preserve is it's surrounded by the city, but you get just a few miles into it and you feel like you're in the middle of nowhere. And in particular, there was this man named Willie Brown who owned all this land. I know you wrote about him, Mark. And when he died, he dedicated all his acreage to the National Park Service with the specific intention that it never be developed. And that became the Theodore Roosevelt area, correct?
That's right. Just a phenomenal story about this somewhat of a reclusive man who lived in the woods who could have sold all of that for millions of dollars and donated it to us. And now it's miles and miles of hiking trail. Yeah. And we're actually working on a plan right now to connect all of that with Fort Caroline and the Ribaud Monument so you can come and do all of that in one day with your family.
You can hike all of it as an interconnected path.
Interconnected. That's what we're working on right now.
How exciting.
Yeah.
When do you think that might be done?
We're in the early planning stages right now, so we're we've gotten a grant to actually study where we'd put the trails, and so it'll be, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5 years out before we actually see it implemented.
Pretty cool, but in the meantime, you can visit the Timucuan Preserve, the Kingsley Plantation, the Rebolt Monument, all of these areas right now, and you can read "Lassoing the Sun: A Year in America's National Parks." Also, are you guys doing an appearance at some point soon? What's happening?
I'm doing a REI, a talk about the National Monument Review, kind of national parks in the news, and also try and tie it to the book and a book signing Saturday, November 25th, so the Black Friday weekend, 1 to 3 p.m. at REI. It's free, but they ask that you sign up online, so if you go to REI.com, sign up for that.
There you go. Yeah, your book would be a nice stocking stuffer this year for anyone who loves the parks. And, you know, Chris Hughes, you've been in the job, a year now?
A little over
so?
2 years.
2 years mm-hmm. now.
Time flies.
Well, I can't believe I've been this lax in getting you on the air because, as I said, your predecessor, Barbara Goodman, had the job for quite some time, and she did a wonderful job. And I'm glad to welcome you, a relatively new face, not really as new as I thought, to this studio to talk about this. He is Chris Hughes, the Timucuan Park Superintendent. And I'm also always happy to chat with Mark Woods, columnist for the Florida Times Union, author of Lassoing the Sun, A Year in America's National Parks. Now, let me ask you really quickly, they're having a public comment on these fee increases for the big parks. Are you hearing any chit-chat through the National Park Service about how that's going?
No, we actually I just read a statement that that information and where to public on or comment on that is actually readily available. So just Google it, or I can get you the information. And we encourage people to reach out and comment and express their opinions about the increase.
Are you getting an earful?
Not yet.
Really?
You know, because we don't charge fees, so everybody's just really happy that they can still come see us for free.
That's right. In Jacksonville, it's free. Maybe not at Yellowstone and so forth, but here in Jacksonville, you can come and enjoy the national park for free. And by the way, Superintendent Hughes, you came in full uniform today. You've got the park ranger hat, the whole thing. It's very impressive. So
thanks.
I love seeing you guys in uniform. And thanks for coming out. Thanks for sharing this with us. And again, go see Mark Woods on Black Friday.
It's the Saturday, the day after today.
Black Saturday.
Yes.
At REI at the St. Johnstown Center and get a copy of his book. Thanks, guys. In a moment, Cole Pepper, as the Gators say goodbye to their football coach after getting throttled by Georgia. That and a look at the rest of the weekend sports news and notes.
Do you really read the fine print on your cell phone bill or credit card statement? After the financial crash, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was created to rein in bad practices, but its detractors say it does more harm than good. And critics in Congress have now barred customers from banding together to take on the big banks. Who now is watching Wall Street? That's next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, John Hodgman, contributor to The Daily Show and This American Life. He gets personal in his new collection of funny essays. In high school, he wore long hair, a fedora, and carried a briefcase.
That's the look I was going for in high school. Emotionally terrified weirdo who was tricking people into thinking he was interesting by wearing funny clothes.
Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On March 2, 1800, two men had an altercation in downtown St. Augustine that resulted in one of the men's death. Both men were slaves. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll discuss this fascinating murder investigation with Jim Cusick. We'll talk about 19th century property surveys in Florida and the Central Florida Navy League. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Accountants tend to look at the tax code like a game.
You often have world champion chess players playing against much lower paid and busier professionals.
I'm Adrienne Hill. Accountants try to checkmate the IRS. Next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, a big mid-season change in Gainesville.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Culpepper is here now with a look at the fallout after Florida-Georgia weekend. Hey, Cole.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, it was quite a week for Florida head coach Jim McElwain, now the former Florida head coach.
And yeah.
I mean, it's not just the game, the reason why they let Jim McElwain go. Let me kind of backtrack and tell a little bit of the storyline of how the train kind of got going down the tracks here. In some ways, you can actually say that part of this equation was the fact that McElwain was hired as a guy to come in as an offensive coach and re-energize the Florida offense that had been so terrible under Will Muschamp. The problem has been the offense has been brutal the last 3 years. So that's one mark against McElwain in this whole process. That wasn't alone going to get him fired at this point of the season. Mm-hmm. Before the year began, remember the nine players that were suspended for the opener against the Michigan Wolverines? We talked about that here on the show and about the impact that that would have on the season.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about how that could impact the way that the Gators went about things with a couple of the key players. That was a factor for sure. And not that they were suspended. They should have been suspended. But the fact that you had this many players who were caught up in this debit card scandal you kind of started thinking, well, okay, why wasn't this better policed, number one? Number two, how he handled that in his interactions with the administration brought a little bit of an eyebrow raise to
sure.
some extent.
Sure.
Then I think really the coup de grace was this past week at his Monday press conference, McElwain started talking about receiving death threats from the Gator Nation, the pressure that he had been under, that he and his family were feeling. And
my God.
When the administration asked him to expound on that, he was very vague. And he was vague. He had given several chances during the course of the week to walk the comments back, talking about that in a press conference on Wednesday. He did not walk them back at all. He was more evasive than anything. He had several offers from Steve Spurrier to help him kind of work through some issues with the offense. He twice declined Steve Spurrier. So all in all these things considered as part of the recipe, capped off by a 42-7 loss to the Georgia Bulldogs, where before the game, he told his team he was going to get fired. Now,
that's not exactly a motivator, is it?
And I think maybe he thought it would be. Like they would all rally around Coach Mack or something.
Huh.
And it just didn't work out. So he's gone. Now, let's look forward as far as the Gators are concerned. Athletic Director Scott Strickland says it wasn't just about the three straight losses. There was really much more, as I mentioned, that really went into this whole thing.
This is more than just wins and losses. And I'll just leave it at that. And I don't know if there was any one seminal moment, but it just seemed like this was the time to do it.
Yeah, it really was the time. Had to be done. So now what? Well, I'm going to talk about some candidates here in a moment, but let's hear from Strickland, who will be making his first football coach hire as athletic director at Florida. This can be a legacy-making kind of decision if he makes the right call. So what kind of a coach is he looking for?
Whether it's hard work, whether it's character, whether it's competitiveness, their ability to sell both to fans and to recruits. These are figure-it-out kind of jobs. Every school is different. Every school is unique. Every school has its own set of strengths and challenges, and there's not a one-size-fits-all approach to what's going to be successful at every single school.
So you can put together a list of candidates who fit some of those criteria that he's talking about, and whether you're mm-hmm. talking about 8 or 13 or 17 or 21 candidates – Scott Strickland already knows some of the guys he wants to reach out to, maybe all the guys he wants to reach out to. Among them are Dan Mullen, the former Florida offensive coordinator, who was Tim Tebow's quarterback's coach when he was with the Gators. He was Dak Prescott's coach at Mississippi State. He was Alex Smith's coach at Utah, who became first-round pick. He is out of the Urban Meyer mold, and so there's something there. There are other coaches who have Florida connections. Bob Stoops, the former defensive coordinator, recently retired from Oklahoma. And I will just ask this. At what point is Steve Spurrier brought into this conversation?
Yeah, right.
I don't know about coach, but consultant to talk about it. Going to be interesting to follow
things in Gainesville. Little consigliere action there.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. So meanwhile, this is all happening while Georgia, their big rival, is now number two in the country. They took a couple of first-place votes away from Alabama, and they look like a team that can actually challenge Alabama in the SEC East. And their other rival, Florida State, going the other direction, 2-5 after a 35-3 loss to Boston College on Friday night. Seminoles are in danger of not making a bowl game. So it has been a tumultuous season for football in the state of Florida.
Meanwhile, the Jaguars are back to work. The Bengals come into town Sunday.
And the Jaguars will have a new player on the field when they do. They traded on Friday for Marcell Dareus, former two-time Pro Bowl defensive tackle. This is a guy who was a first-round pick, former Alabama star. I think it's a huge move for the Jaguars. They only gave up a sixth-round pick to get him. And he's a guy who can immediately help the run defense, which has really been the only thing the defense hasn't been very good at this year. They've been terrific otherwise. And this is the kind of move that really makes a statement that the Jaguars are going for the playoffs right now, and they think that they're not far off from being a playoff team.
Let's cross our fingers for that. Meanwhile, the Armada ended their season on a high note.
A 2-0 win at San Francisco. They needed a win and to get some help to get into the postseason. They did not get the help from Puerto Rico, who needed to beat the New York Cosmos in order for them to get in. But it's going to be interesting. First offseason with Robert Palmer as the owner. What does he do in terms of keeping this core group together? He's already signed his head coach and his general manager and team president to long-term contracts.
But he's kind of made a splash, hasn't he?
No doubt. He's put some money back into things, kind of re-energizing the team. And they're in a very good position. Just, you know, the first team out of the playoffs, they just didn't quite make it. But certainly on an upward trajectory with Mark Lowry as the head coach. There are a number of players they're going to have to make some decisions on. Typically, there's a fair amount of turnover in the North American Soccer League from year to year. But I think you're going to see this core group of players, by and large, try to be kept together.
All right. Always good to talk to you. Follow Cole on Twitter for all your sports news and notes. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corgram runs the board during the hour. And the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross. And you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.